when I hear somebody say, you know, stay in your lane, I'm like, oh, that sounds like a challenge.
Challenge accepted.
Exactly. Like my lane is really wide. It's extremely windy, hilly, and yeah, I'm gonna come over and see what you're doing because it looks like it might be fun too, and I'm really curious and like to have fun.
Connecting the dots with the Renaissance people.
Renaissance people and folks who are looking forward to cultivating a Renaissance mindset. So excited to have you join for my very first guest episode because I've got one of my best friends on. And so, you know, rather than talking around it, let's just jump right into it. Here we go. I want to start off. I give you a list of some terms. These are some terms that I've been using to promote my business, Renaissance Woman Consulting, and this exciting new podcast. And Nancy Scales Coddington, which term aligns best with your identity? Renaissance person, or woman, man, whatever it might be, multi-passionate, generalist, versatilist, Jack, Jill, Jay of all trades, boundary spanner, or is there another term that you like to use?
Yes to all of those.
Such a Renaissance person answer.
Right?
Well played. Yes and.
Yes and. I will take yes and. I think I'm going to go with multi-passionate because that really drives everything that I do. If I'm not passionate, I lose interest pretty quickly and, you know, move on like I think many Renaissance people do.
Excellent. Well, for today, I am very excited to have multi-passionate, wonderful, close friend of mine, close friend, colleague, collaborator, conspirator, whatever we want to be with alliteration, Nancy Scales Coddington. She is known as the redheaded steminist on multiple social media platforms, and she's joining me today as my very first guest on Connecting the Dots with the Renaissance People. Background is that we both got to know each other from being involved with a Girls in STEM initiative called SciGirls and the National Girls Collaborative Project. We've done just a lot of girls and women in STEM work, but we share so many other areas of interest. So we've had a close friendship for many years now, and it's so exciting to have you supporting me and joining me on this podcast. I'd love to have you help us. You are multi-passionate. You're interested in a lot of things. So could you share with our listeners, what are some of your areas of expertise? Where are you a known quantity, as you might say?
Well, I am really thrilled to be your first guest on the podcast. So thank you so much for asking me. I was really over the moon when you did ask. So very exciting and congratulations on launching. I know this is always, it's exciting and you got to get there and it's, you just got to take that leap and do it because you can spend so much time. What can I do better? What can I do better? And you and I both know how that goes.
Recovering perfectionists.
Yep, we're there. I love that. So I guess with what I'm a known quantity for is talking about education, being a science communicator. I've really spent my career bridging science and storytelling, helping people to see that STEM isn't, you know, it's not just equations or labs and boring. It's creativity. It's all about building community. It's about innovation. And it's about holding space for people to also join that. And I love to say that I also helped us translate science into stories, you know, that people actually want to listen to. Because if you can't share what you know, it's like not knowing at all.
I love that. And I think you and I have a background in being in TV. You're on the PBS side. I was on TV as both a meteorologist as well as a reporter. And so storytelling, I think, has been part of our lives. And science storytelling in particular has been part of our lives. I think one of the things that I see, and maybe you can tell me if this rings true with you, is when I came up with the term Renaissance woman, I was a little hesitant because I never want to box people in. I never want to force people in one direction. And if we think of the classic Renaissance man, Leonardo da Vinci, he had a STEM side and he had an artist side. So sometimes I worry that Renaissance person, because of that classic definition of Renaissance, goes to somebody who has a STEM side and an artist side, that I might box people in who are multi-passionates, but STEM is not one of their areas of being a multi-passionate. I'd be curious to hear your take on that. Do you think that by choosing the term Renaissance woman, being a little feminist play on Renaissance man, does that say to people that this is only for people who have a STEM side and an art side, a left brain and a right brain fully operating? Or what do you think?
It's an interesting question, because I didn't actually think that when you came up with that name for your business. I went more to the knowing a lot about a lot of different things, but maybe not having the breadth in those things. So a Jack or Jill of all trades, or somebody who has that, you know, tragic, I saw something that somebody just built this canoe, and you know what? I think I can do that too, even though I have no concept of what's going on there.
Let's jump in feet first.
Exactly. Exactly. So I went more that route of looking at people who bridge all of those different gaps, who work in maybe one industry but have a lot of friends maybe in the art, and they are not artists, they are not engineers, you know, they're not science people, you know, maybe they are a chef, but they also have this great creativity to bring in the art concepts of it. So I really felt with that name, you were casting a very wide net and really wrapping your arms around a community of people who want to be in that space. And the invitation is there if you want to come forward. And, you know, if you're still kind of like, oh, I'm not really quite sure, there's still room for you on the edges. And once you decide how amazing all the Renaissance Women Consulting services are and how great Sarah is, then you want to jump into the community and be part of it.
I love that. Yeah. As I thought about it more, I thought about, well, Renaissance as a term isn't limited to Western Europe, white civilization, that sort of thing. There's the Harlem Renaissance that I remember learning about in school. And I jokingly wanted to make a post about, and I double checked these numbers. I used the term Renaissance woman before Beyonce did. So I'm flattered that she took my idea and ran with it. But then I didn't want to like offend people. Well, I'm making that post. So
I heard that's where she got the idea. She got it from you.
I know. Yeah. So I want it to be not limiting. I don't want people to think that this is just for STEM people who are also artists. It's broad. It's not limited to white people. It's not limited to a lot of things. And so I'm glad that you get that. And a lot of things that I'm going to be talking about for people is what you alluded to, which is like that Renaissance mindset, as I'm calling it, which is the idea that there is a lot of value from having knowledge from a lot of different areas and integrating it together and coming up with creative solutions and like thinking outside the box. That's what we do best. And I'm curious, where do you think you've thrived as a Renaissance woman, where they've really appreciated the fact that you do have that Renaissance mindset?
I think one of the areas that I have been thriving in the last few years is taking my creativity and my STEM background and fusing that with fashion. I created this Galaxy Goddess dress it was last year, for a national STEM fashion show. And the theme was space. And I looked at that thinking, okay, well, you know, we have constellations, we have planets, we have the sun, and the sun, you know, obviously is amazing visually. How do you translate the story of the universe into an outfit? You know, not a collection, one outfit.
This is not Project Runway, folks. This is, you know, one.
You know,
episode.
Make it work.
That's right. And you did. Oh my gosh, it's amazing. And here we go. This is, if we said we could make it like a drinking game, we're going to put it in the show notes. So take your first sip of water or whatever you have. You have an Instagram post that you put up recently that I fell in love with, which was stating something that I state very often, which is, I'm not in one niche. You're not niching me down. That's not how I'm going to find success. And my career coach, Jenny Gritters, And actually, it was another person in our group. We were talking the other day, and they were talking about how this year, 2025 in particular, all these people who niched down in the last couple of years are all of a sudden realizing that, oh man, I'm not prepared for the world that we're in right now. And having those like broad interests and the ability to like jump around and do different things and connect things together seems like more and more of an asset, honestly.
Yeah, absolutely. And you are right and right on time with that. You know, the niche down, especially when you're looking at marketing, which I do a lot of work with in my SciComm Solutions business, is that niche down and what is it that you do and do it really well and make sure everybody knows that you do that. And that, you know, obviously that's very true in marketing. You want that repetitive piece in there. But as a person who has many interests, it's very difficult to niche down, you know, especially for Renaissance people, because while there are still new things to discover within a topic, it's much more fun to take all of these topics and kind of mash them together, you know? And so talking about the dress that I did, it was taking fiber optics and it was taking circuits and putting that together with the fashion. And how do you actually make that come together and look like a galaxy? How do you pull from all the different things that you know and be able to build on that creativity? And I think those are the people who are not niching down, who are going to be excelling. And especially like with social media, I think in the next year, you're going to see definitely a lot more of that.
Love that. And I believe you actually won the competition, right?
Yes.
Because the making of the outfits was a competition. First
place,
yes, was
yep.
it?
I won for the STEM fashion show, and then I displayed that at the Space Gala later that year with Reinvented Magazine. And then I actually wore the dress to a One Space event that happened this year and won Best Outfit, which was really exciting. And then the dress has now gone international. I recently wore it in Costa Rica, a similar thing, and then it also won an award while I was there as well. So the dress has... Yes.
International award-winning designer, STEMinist, Nancy Scales Coddington is my first guest. I love it. That's so cool. And it's so neat to see so many people recognize your creativity, see how you mesh things together and say, I get it. Because sometimes our creativity is a little overwhelming yes. to people.
Guilty as charged.
What are you doing? Why are you going off in that direction? Well, I think you answered my question, but I'm going to give you a chance if there's another answer that you have for my next question, which is our title of this podcast is Connecting the Dots with the Renaissance People. Obviously, you're a Renaissance woman. How do you connect the dots in your life or in your work? Do you have another example?
How do I connect the dots? One of the ways that I connect the dots is with my work with educators and also with youth. There's so many people out there who don't see themselves as scientists or see themselves as engineers. And they might be curious about those things, but, you know, they hear science and, you know, maybe they didn't have a good experience in school or, you know, for whatever reason, it causes them anxiety. And so they pull away from it. I'm not a science person. And that's not for me. And I'm not good at math. And I was told that, you know, engineering is only for boys. So I love working with people who don't think science is for them. And I call them my STEM curious people. And science is everywhere. Everywhere you look, there's science around you. You know, from the phone that never leaves the vicinity of your hand to the trees outside and, you know, with the photosynthesis. And now here we are in fall with things changing and the leaves falling. I mean, there's just science everywhere. So to be able to make a space and hold that for them and watch the discovery of STEM concepts or STEM activities, you know, whether it's doing soft circuits and building, you know, a circuit bracelet with a group of Psy girls, as you had mentioned, and watching that light bulb go off thinking, wow, this is science and I'm doing this and I really like it. And that opens up a whole world for them. And that really gets me excited because who knows then what they're going to do with that new knowledge, but also that know-how that this is for them. And that's just super exciting.
But when you serve in that dot connecting capacity, you've got the background in science. Your undergraduate degree was exactly what again?
I have a degree in environmental science.
Okay. So you've got the science background. What in your background allows you to be kind of the translator for the people who feel like they don't belong in science? What allows you to like speak their language, understand their hesitancies?
That's a great question. I started my career actually as a museum educator and worked with students doing all kinds of different science activities. One of my favorite was liquid nitrogen because, I mean,
yes. Oh my goodness. One of my literally cool. And like blowing things up.
Yes. Freezing things, smashing them. And then I created a whole food science program. So we would make liquid nitrogen ice cream, which, you know, is that's what Dippin' Dots is. They freeze that with liquid nitrogen and then have to keep it, you know, super cold. But being able to take these really fun phenomena and share those with students really opened up my eyes to like, wow, this is really cool. And I'm excited to do this all day and get paid for it and watch that excitement in people's eyes. So I started doing that back, 20 some years ago.
We're not setting an age. We're just saying we are knowledgeable from our years
of experience. Exactly. And so I did that for about 7 or 8 years and then transitioned into working for a PBS and NPR affiliate. And from there, I was hired for my grant organization skills and came on board into their education department, but built well beyond that and really learned that storytelling while I spent time at that PBS and NPR affiliate. So I built my science communication skills, my ability to share information with people, bring them along with that story. And I love to view that as a challenge. So here we have this concept. How do I take the people who are in front of me and make this information, one, relevant, right? If it's not relevant, we don't care. You could have the coolest thing in the world, but if somebody doesn't care or see the relevance in their lives, they're going to tune out. They're not going to pay attention. I actually just did an example with my dad. I was trying to get him to point C, but speak his language to get there. And it worked. It was really good. And he was like, oh, I see what you're saying now. So knowing your audience, super crucial, right? Because that's how you're going to tailor what your message is. And practicing being able to share that information. So I spent a lot of time doing that and helping to connect those dots. And I loved working with all the different audiences because I can work with youth. I work a lot with the middle school age. And I really love science communication with adults. So I would do a podcast called Science Pub, and we would bring on scientists and they would share all of their great information. But then it was me between the scientist and our audience in how do we make some of those connections or how do we come back to some of those concepts and elaborate so that it was able to be digested in smaller bites there. So I think that's one of the ways that I help connect the dots is knowing who I'm talking to and being able to bring them along the journey with me to get to the excitement. That's a lot of fun.
So much fun. And you and I, that's another way that our stories overlap because I was also in science museums, blowing things up and all of that really fun stuff that makes life more amazing. But before that, I was a meteorologist on TV. And one of my favorite phrases that you've heard me say before is, I love weather because I call it the gateway drug to STEM. And I can talk to a 3-year-old and I can talk to a 93-year-old with dementia. And it's that word relevant. It matters in their life. They have life experiences. When I give talks, I got to be the guest meteorologist at my oldest daughter's third grade assembly last school year. And every time I talk about weather and I'm like, does anyone have a question? Immediately, like 20 hands go up and they all want to tell a story. It's not a question. I have to remind them. Remember, questions end with your voice going up at the end. And then they're like, oh, yeah. And I've talked to a preschool. I was their virtual STEM star of the week.
Oh, I love that.
And, you know, 4-year-olds. They all have a story because they've all experienced it in some sort of way. And like with your work with nature, I love, I'm going to throw it in the show notes, take a drink. I love your video where you went outside and you saw the mist coming off of the trees. And honestly, it's a It's just a video where initially you're just like marveling at how cool nature is. And then you throw in, you know, a little bit of like scientific knowledge and like kind of an explanation of it. But it's just a holy cow, isn't this awesome? This is so cool. And that's like the best part to me is when you can tap into emotions, because research from cognitive science, neuroscience has told us that when it comes to learning and particularly retention of knowledge that we've learned, when it can be tied to an emotion, you're more likely to save it in your mind because it actually gets processed in a different part of your brain. And so I think that's one of the things that like science museums do a good job of when you're watching things on TV. Any good science storyteller is not just, like you said, giving you the facts, the here, memorize all the phylum. And
exactly.
That's why I didn't like biology, because it felt like all I was doing was memorizing, except for Punnett squares. Like that, I was like, I'm using my brain. This is fun. But I didn't like biology because it felt like straight up memorization of facts. And that wasn't what I was really excited about. It was more like when I got into chemistry and I was applying it, or physics and we're building and launching eggs and doing a project with my dad, and he launched an egg into a part of our house, and my mom got mad.
And that's why you remember that.
Fun memories, yeah, exactly. Like that. And that's what, because there's the emotion, the trigger of, yeah, that was just like a fun thing to do. A lot of people in the SciComm science communication space do talk about the power of storytelling, but I think like the real part of storytelling that's special is the emotions that it elicits. And we're designed as a species to communicate with each other through stories. That's what we do. That's why there's cave drawings. That's what we've been doing since, you know, we started being a species, is like tell stories. So I always find that really interesting.
You bring up a really good point about that, because with history being passed down, it came through storytelling, right? And so those stories had to be memorable because they weren't getting written down, but absolutely a huge tie-in with the emotion. And when someone goes to tell a story, when they're sharing something in a group, they will often smile or laugh before they start telling that story. And so you already are setting somebody up. Well, good, this is going to be a good one, right? She's excited about it, so I can't wait to hear this. But that's that emotion that ties right in with that memory. I think that's a really good point that you bring up with that.
What do you think about the negative emotion side of it? Because we know that that can be powerful too. We know that politicians run negative ads because people are more likely to be triggered and remember things when they're mad. How do we, as either science communicators or storytellers, think about the responsible, I'll say, use of negative emotions when we're trying to communicate a story?
Yeah, so that is difficult. I mean, that's very similar to trying to change people's mind who are really set on a concept that may or may not be true. But it is difficult because you need to really see where they're coming from. And I think listening, if you have the opportunity to listen to their side, you know, their argument for it, or you know, where is that negativity coming? And then how do you take that and spin it back into a positive? And, you know, there is, okay, well, you have a point there. But, you know, thinking about that, how can we make this in a positive? You don't tell them that's what you're doing, but you just kind of lead them on that path. And it at least gives them either an aha moment or something additional to think about. Because we know as science communicators that a lot of times you're not going to change people's minds, especially with just facts and, you know, well, this is what the science says. And then like, well, yeah, for the next 10 minutes. And then the science is going to change next week. And that's true because science is fluid. Yes.
Yes.
And so that
it's a process.
It is a process. And so, you know, that becomes its own, you know, conversation in itself of, you know, the ever-changing things of science. And I also think that's where a lot of distrust came in science, especially as we went through the pandemic, because people were watching the scientific process play out in front of them. And they weren't being reminded that this is a process. Because with those processes, right, there comes recommendations, which are incredibly important, especially when you're talking about your health and your family's health, your loved ones. But things do change. And the more information you get allows you to make better decisions or use that information in a way that, you know, is helpful. And I think reminding people of that is very important in that scientific process.
I want to circle back to something that you said before that really rang true to me, which is the concept of creativity. I think that, and I've been annoyed, I've seen posters of the left brain and the right brain, and they're talking about one side is the analytical science math side, and then the other side is your artistic side, and then the word creativity so often ends up limited to that one artistic side. I think Renaissance people are particularly good at applying creativity in such a way that it belongs on the left side, it belongs on the right side, and it belongs in the activities that they do that connect both sides. How do you think about creativity, particularly towards that STEM side, which doesn't always get credit for being creative?
Absolutely. Yeah, totally. And oftentimes on the STEM side, if you are being creative, people will be like, oh, you're so arts and craftsy. Like, no, I'm building a boat. Like that's engineering. So there's a massive amount in creativity with STEM, you know, everything from thinking about setting up an experiment. If you're doing something and you're trying to find out the answer, you're going through a process that other people have not done before. So you need to be creative in how you're going to set that up. So you have your known quantities, but as you are moving through, you have those questions. And how are you going to get to the answer? Because other people haven't gotten there. And that's a huge amount of creativity. So you need to decide how you want to run the experiment, you know, what other components are going to come into that, what partnerships make sense to be part of that project. And then once you finish your experiment, how are you going to share out that information? You know, of course, you're going to write your white paper. That is one of the things in how you get credit for all the work that you've been doing. But people, I know this is a spoiler, normal people don't read white papers.
Except for Renaissance nerds who read it for fun.
Exactly.
Like me. I admit it, but not always. Most of the time I don't learn from actually like going on Google Scholar and finding the paper.
If you want to share that information, you've got to get creative in how you're going to do it. And so depending on what it is you are doing, is part of your project sharing with youth? How are you going to turn this into a hands-on activity that makes sense and is relevant to youth and also shares your findings, right? And a great example, because of my background is environmental science, is one of the professors that I have worked with in her classes, Professor Wah, teaching science communication, is she looks at toxins and how they accumulate in amphibians. And so for many, many years, she's been catching them. She walks right through the whole cycle when they're hatching with frogs, and then looking at that bioaccumulation, what's happening to those frogs as additional, you know, salts they're exposed to from the road salts and other runoff that comes into their habitats. And so she is looking at so many complex things going on, not only in the habitat, but then also in those amphibians, and then being able to share that information out. She's done such an amazing job working with her undergrads where they have created a book. And so the book goes through and identifies who these creatures and those little critters are. You've got your spotted salamanders, which I love. You've got, you know, your green frogs and your toads, and then talks about how do these pollutants end up in their habitat. What does that mean for them? And so they use that. They also use comics to be able to explain this information because they are going for an older demographic. So it could be upper middle to high school and into adults. So sharing information, there's massive amounts of creativity. You know, thinking about our engineers, they are so incredibly talented. They're solving problems that, you know, I didn't even know I had. And you have to be incredibly creative to do that, because again, you're coming at something, you've got some restrictions around, you know, how you're going to create or solve this problem, and then you need to be creative in figuring that out. So I agree with you that not enough attention is given to that creativity in STEM, but it is used all over the place.
Yeah. And I, as I think about it, sometimes I use STEM just to refer to all four of the fields. Sometimes I use it to refer to the integration of the fields, two different ideas. And we won't even get started on STEAM today because that's for another episode. We've already complained about that in person. But what it makes me think about is maybe there's a slight difference between those four letters. If I think about engineering and technology, and even how it's taught and incorporated in elementary, middle school, I think there's more credit given to the creativity to be an engineer or to like create an app or something like that. People would label that as creative, but science and math, the way it's often taught in elementary school, middle school, high school, even undergraduate, unless you're an undergraduate who's involved in active research, you're still mainly getting knowledge given to you. And you're not given the opportunity necessarily to creatively say, well, what's next? Where can I go with this? Or even how can I communicate this to others? Because that's another way, again, that's creativity in science communication. So I feel like science and math, it's probably not until you get to like your master's, your PhD, and that sort of realm where they really are answering questions that nobody knows the answer to yet. Versus engineering and technology, you're creating products and being creative even at a young age. Do you see that sort of thing? Or feel free to push back against me if you disagree. I'm fine with that.
So I do agree. I mean, content obviously is hugely important. You know, you have to have that content knowledge before you can move forward. And it does seem that a lot of that does wait until you are into your master's or into a doctorate program, which then means a lot of people don't get to experience that. So I am going to push back on where you can put creativity into those spaces. And one of those is thinking about designing an experiment. And I know that that has been a push in particular New York State in reworking science education standards is allowing kids the time, which is always the constraint, the opportunity to figure out how do you actually design, you know, an experiment, because that does take a lot of thought and it does take creativity, because while, you know, a lot of that has been laid out and given as an example, they have the ability to still add in their own little bits of creativity, which I think is really important because that's where you're going to garner that interest from youth, from college students. And while there's less room for some of that creativity, I think in like out of school spaces, there's a huge amount of opportunity for that. And that's one of the reasons I love working in those spaces is you have the luxury of time. And you, yep. Which is, I mean, like that's what you start with, right? You can take the time and design the experiment and walk through how that process works and have the students do it, because we're so used to just being pushed with content and this is how you do it. And here, now take a test and good job. And everybody's happy and moves. But what did you actually learn? Right. And then you forget the facts and you can look up your facts on your phone. But it's that process of what do I do with this information? And that, with that critical thinking, is key to the success of anyone, right? So I would say leaning into that and taking that content and turning it into a different project, you know, instead of just going through maybe like an experiment, how do we take what we learned and communicate it and open the door to how would you communicate this to like your parents if they're coming in on the last day of camp? Can you do, you know, a PowerPoint presentation? Can you make a video? Can you act out what your experiment was? Really tapping into that, which brings back in the emotion piece that you had mentioned earlier. And then those are the experiences that those kids are going to remember. They're not going to remember the facts. They're going to remember how they felt. They're going to remember the process that they did go through and sharing that information out and the creativity that they used there.
I love that. And I think you make a super valid clap back in my direction, because I think that the next generation science standards and even the new math, the new way that we are teaching math, is bringing more creativity in the process. were with the next generation science standards. It's definitely written into the science standards now that they broke it out where it's not just like, here's the facts you have to memorize, but here are the science and engineering practices. These are the things scientists really do. Here's the cross-cutting concepts, which be the connecting the dots in my mind of, hey, here's where this biology idea goes with chemistry, goes with your history class, goes with English literature. And they even have suggestions of like how to make it more interdisciplinary, which I love. So I think that the more people are embracing and actually utilizing what's in the next generation science standards, the better it's getting. Out of school time has always been strong in that realm. And in fact, out of school time, the informal science education field played a big role in informing the next generation science standards. I actually got to sit in on a meeting when they were coming up with it when I was at the Science Center of Iowa. And they were like, yep, we want your input too as people doing informal science to what we can do in classrooms. And then for the math part of it, I know I'm a parent now trying to teach a first and fourth grader how to do their math. And I'm reading every take-home packet that they send me because I know that it's different than the way you and I learned it. But the strength of it is that we're teaching the kids how to actually think. And for them to realize that there's multiple ways we could get the answer to most math problems and that there's not a right way. Here's the way we're practicing today. Here's another way we're going to practice it. Here's another way that we're going to practice it. So you have that skill and then you're going to pick the one that feels best to you. And that's creativity.
Absolutely.
Right?
And I think if that was talked about more and leaned into, there would be less hesitance in learning and teaching and working with your kids on the new math.
Yeah. And I think there's the, like we talk, you and I, a lot about identity and we talk about building STEM identity for students and for students. And I think our society, especially in the US, Western Europe, pushes girls are creative. And if their identity is I'm a creative person, and then they see STEM as not a creative realm, then I don't belong in STEM because that is in contrast with my identity as a creative
Absolutely.
Person. That's why I love some of the projects. Like there's a number of projects that I know about that involve dancing and STEM, like dancing science. I went through a training from the Kennedy Center for the Arts about how to actually design training to teach students, not just dance. Yep, Nancy and I are both dancing in our seats. Not just how to teach students science and then like let them go free, but we actually teach the correct terms of dance and talk about like connect the dots between here's how cycle in science aligns with the idea of a cycle or choreography in music or in dance. So there's a lot of overlap there that if you don't have the opportunity to learn about both areas, you might not make that connection. You might not connect the dots. So it takes that Renaissance person mindset of, I'm going to find out about dance. I'm going to find out about science. I'm going to see these patterns and these similar conversations happening in both places. And I'm going to connect the dots. And I'm going to be the translator. I'm going to be the intermediary who knows about both things and can help people.
Absolutely. You know, that makes me think of a project that I did at the public media station I worked at, WSKG, and it was movement. And when you're doing movement and you're learning, you're literally building new pathways in the brain, right? There's a lot of research that talks about that. And so we would do these movement videos while doing different subject levels. So for example, math, like skip counting, obviously that's super easy, right? You can do the movement. Math was really good for movement. You had to be more creative when you're trying to bring it into science concepts. And as you were talking about that with the cycle, made me think of one of the videos that we did on monarch butterflies. And so going through the metamorphosis and the whole cycle and laying the eggs and the movement that the kids would do as they would go through that, they would remember those processes. And one of the teachers that I have had feedback from was they could see the kids while they were taking, you know, a test on this, like doing the dance at their seats, like with short little movements, and they could see their lips moving as they were like recalling it. But that's what they use to pull back on that content. Yeah. And that stuff's all still available on WSKG on their YouTube. So if you're interested, it'll be in the show notes.
make a drink. Yes. And there's lots of research to support that. The program from the Kennedy Center for the Arts did some like longitudinal research, and these kids who danced the water cycle, when tested on that topic, months later, sure enough, they remembered it longer. And again, it's because you're embedding the knowledge in multiple parts of your brain. It's the emotion. You're having fun. You're moving around. For a neurodivergent child who really struggles to sit still, you're actually physically moving your body, which can sometimes help your brain remember things better. You're doing it with friends. There's that sense of community. And I know that's another thing you and I love is building community. You have a sense of identity as I am one of the dancers. I am the larva. I am the monarch. I actually did an activity with preschoolers where we danced the monarch cycle, and then I ran a STEAM camp and we danced the life cycle of a dinosaur. Ooh. And we also danced the water cycle because, you know, a meteorologist has to do dancing the water cycle. Okay. So at the beginning, I didn't do this intro for you, Nancy. And I could have like read a bio. And it wouldn't have even touched on all of the different things that you've done. Like, that's why I tell people, just go to my LinkedIn page, scroll through the experience. And yep, I've done that. Yeah, I taught a bell choir for people with learning disabilities. And I also, you know,
love
it's all these random things that people don't realize. And for a long time, I was like, I don't know how to introduce myself without overwhelming people.
Yes.
I'm too much. Now that I found Renaissance woman as a term and I'm using it, that helps me feel a little bit better of I'm not diminishing myself. I'm giving people a taste of like I'm complex and deal with it. But how do you introduce yourself to people like when you get that dreaded question, like, what do you do? How do you handle that so that they realize you're complex without like overwhelming them?
Yeah, that's in process still.
And always will be.
Yes, I think I usually chuckle at the question because, like you, it's very, very similar. You know, I have things that I have done from all over the place, and trying to whittle that down into something that somebody can pigeonhole you with, I don't really like to be put into one lane. And I, you know, when you were talking, I think actually about in your trailer for the podcast about, you know, being on a tangent or staying in your lane. When I hear somebody say, you know, stay in your lane, I'm like, oh, that sounds like a challenge.
Challenge accepted.
Exactly. Like my lane is really wide. It's extremely windy, hilly. And yeah, I'm going to come over and see what you're doing because it looks like it might be fun too. And I'm really curious and like to have fun. So my elevator speech is that I help to bridge science with storytelling. I help the STEM curious to find their STEM identity and space in out of school or after school spaces. And I fill in those check marks.
Exactly.
You know, I'm a hiker. I love to be outside. I love to make impromptu videos about that, as you had mentioned earlier about the water vapor, which was really cool.
You're a dog lover.
And I overthink my content too much. So it was really cool that day that everything just came together and I didn't overthink it and just posted it really quickly. So there's a tip. Don't overthink your content. You know, I've been doing quite a bit in the STEM fashion world. I have an organization where I do media and marketing, SciComm Solutions, and help with storytelling. And then I work with different organizations helping to create their content. And another really neat thing that I have pulled together is something called STEM Socialite. And this is a community, you know, highlighting people that are doing really cool things in STEM, you know, very similar to Renaissance people. They've got these great engineer projects, or maybe they are, you know, working with NASA, but they also have this creative side and they are going to events or they're making like light up fashion designs. And so that's a space for them as well. And so with that, highlighting some of those people in STEM and on social media, but also on the website as well. So I guess to boil it down is where there's going to be STEM and creativity and fun is where you're going to find me.
I love that. That's a good one. Okay, that needs to be part of your boilerplate language, because that's fabulous.
I just made that up.
I know. Some of the best stuff is the improvised stuff. And speaking of improvising, we're going to play our first game. So improv is part of my background. I've taught theater to youth. I've been highly involved in theater. My brother has a BFA in musical theater. He's the one who made the theme song for the podcast. We'll have him on another episode. But so our first game is a fill-in-the-blank game. So you and I are going to go back and forth. And we're going to fill in the blank in the same sentence. And the sentence is, you might be a Renaissance person if... dot, dot, dot. So I'll go first. You might be a Renaissance person if, when someone asks you, give me your elevator pitch, you ask, can the elevator go to the moon?
I'm supposed to repeat this, right?
You get to make up your own. So.
Okay.
What is your, you might be a Renaissance person if?
You might be a Renaissance person if, when you are being introduced to a group of people and in your mind, the thought goes, normal people really bore me. Where are the interesting ones?
Yes. Yes. That's great. Okay. Let's do it again. You might be a Renaissance person if, when you see family members, they tell you, I can't keep up with all the things that you're doing. Have you heard that from any family members?
Yes.
Like, what are you doing now?
Exactly. Yes. And my dad,
like, he's like,
when are you going to get her a job?
Like, I'm having too much fun. I've had a few paychecks.
Right.
Okay, your turn.
Yeah. That was a really good one. So you might be a Renaissance person if your LinkedIn profile is scroll, 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 scroll. So true.
It's me. Okay, we can keep going, but okay. For the sake of time, I have two rapidish fire questions. And then at the very end, I'd love to give you a chance to let people know how to follow you, how to learn about your ever evolving, fabulous Renaissance woman self. So my first rapidish fire question is, what is one metaphor that you find yourself using frequently?
A metaphor that I use quite frequently is, if you can't share what you know, it's like not knowing it at all. Dash, Nancy Scales Paddington.
Attribution is right. Important. Okay. What is one rabbit hole that you have gone down recently?
One?
Pick one. Your favorite. It could be the most random. What's one rabbit hole you've gone down recently?
My mind goes blank with these rapid questions. One rabbit hole my mind has gone down recently is exploring LED lights and how the different sizes are available to actually use in clothing. So I have found these very small micro ones and learning how to solder them to create either like a brooch or a pin, and figuring out how I can use them on the bottom part of a pair of high heels. Because I am, you know, you were asking about one of the things that I'm known for is I have high heels that are lit up, and I wear them at STEM events. And so figuring out another way to make them light with all these different kinds of LEDs, because I want to be able to share that with people too. So doing a lot of research in that area. So I guess that would be one of my rabbit holes of late.
I love that. I am, as you've seen multiple times, known for I think people refer to me as the Miss Frizzle lady when I go to events and I wear my dress from Princess Awesome. I would put a link in the show notes. I'll put a link to them, but this dress is no longer being made, so you can't get it, but it is a pie dress. And it's made up of all these different mathematical equations and everything. But the really neat part is that pi is not actually printed on the dress. It's in the negative space. So it's in between the different icons. I'll put a picture of myself proudly wearing it, probably one of me and Nancy hanging out together at an event. We're mainly virtual friends. We like rarely actually see each other as human beings, physical human beings, but I got some pictures out there. So, okay, we'll close things up. I'm sure I'm gonna have you back on again because we like just scratched the surface. But Nancy, if folks want to follow you on your journey, what are some of the best ways for them to
do that? So if you're curious about blending science and storytelling, you can follow me on socials at Nancy Coddington or STEM Socialite. You can also check out my LinkedIn. All that information will be in the show notes or on my website, scicomsolutions.com. And thank you so much, Sarah, for having me today. This was a lot of fun.
This is so great. Well, thank you. And to everyone listening, if you're thinking, hey, I'm a Renaissance person, well, you should come on the show just like Nancy did. I have a spot on my website. I'll put the link in the show notes so that you can submit your information and we can get you scheduled to come on and we'll connect the dots and go off on a tangent and do all the wonderful things that Renaissance people do when they chat with one another and have a hard time stopping. But we will stop. That's what we're going to do. So we'll say goodbye for now and thank you again, Nancy.
Stay curious.
Connecting the dots with the Renaissance people.